What we may miss is that at the beginning of this, Jesus and the disciples just found out that John the Baptist had been killed by Herod. And so they want to go away and be by themselves and just kind of gather their thoughts. And as they travel by boat, this crowd has an idea where they're going. And when the boat pulls up, here's this crowd. And it says, Jesus had compassion. And then right after it said, he was healing them, right? So, you know, we think of the feeding of the 5,000, and that's miraculous, but he's also healing people, and that's what Jesus did in many places. And as we come in today, we have problems of our own. We have challenges. We have stresses in our life. We have things that are temptations to us. So we're going to look at, you know, what are resources that are available. And we have two tables here, but representing four circles of support. And if you pull out this sheet, this will help. This has some of the information from the discussion. It also has some resources on it. The beginning of it has kind of a bio. In just a minute, we'll let the folks introduce themselves. The middle has a list of resources. The back has some more resources, some of the scripture that we referred to today. And then also even more information is available on our website. And also afterwards, these folks will be out in the lobby. So if you want to ask questions or get a little more information, they'll be available. So at this point, I'm going to let folks introduce themselves, and we're going to start with Brian today.
Good morning. My name is Brian McCallum. I'm a counselor with Samaritan Counseling. Samaritan offers hope, help, and healing by providing counseling to individuals, families, as well as faith-based organizations. I'm here today representing the fourth circle of support, even though I'm going first, and my domain is community support.
I am Missy Berg. I have my license in clinical professional counseling. I worked in crisis at a behavioral health hospital and then in private practice. But the past 12 years, I've been in school district 155, and today I represent the third circle of support, which is schools.
And I'm Laura Gilliland. I work here at Emmanuel as the director of children and family ministry. I am passionate about bringing faith into families and kids' lives, both here at Emmanuel and at home, and I represent your church support that you have here.
Good morning. I'm Kimberly Schumacher. I'm the author of a study called Yesterday's Tomorrows, A Search for My Place in God's Loving Legacy. It addresses family history. The study was developed with oversight from Pastor Tiemann here at the church, and I represent the first circle of support for families, friends, and small group connections.
Okay. So about a month ago, I did a sermon that was talking about technology and some of the challenges and also setting healthy boundaries for our children or grandchildren. So as we look at technology, you know, what are some of the challenges that we have or things that we need to be aware of, and how does that affect us in terms of how we communicate with one another, and that affects relationships? So Brian, how would you respond to that?
Well, one dynamic of technology has to do with excessive screen time, especially in the evening. Excessive screen time can actually disrupt children's as well as adult sleeping patterns. Screens actually give off or emit what's known as blue light, and the National Sleep Foundation will tell you that the blue light affects the brain, and specifically, it stops the brain from producing melatonin, which is a hormone that signals the brain and body to go to sleep. Now, we've all suffered from a sleep-deprived night now and then, and the next day we may have felt irritable, grouchy. But there are larger concerns with sleep deprivation having to do with how it affects memory and learning in school or work performance. Also, sleep deprivation compromises the immune system, making us more vulnerable to illnesses and infections. There's a simple solution to this, and families can set a digital curfew. The American Academy of Pediatrics would recommend that children, as well as adults, turn off devices 2 hours before bedtime.
Okay. So as we look at this screen use, how does that affect our children's ability to focus or their attention span?
Keep in mind that the iPhone was invented in 2007. So it's really been a mere decade since mobile devices, whether mobile phones, tablets, gaming devices, have really proliferated in society. So the longitudinal or long-term research is not yet in. However, expect to hear more about how technology affects the developing brain. And keep in mind, the human brain doesn't finish developing until approximately age 25. So some researchers are concerned that, and again, here I'm talking about excessive use of technology, that it can lead to constantly switching tasks, lack of focus, distraction, interruptions, all of which, again, can affect learning and memory, whether that's for children, academic performance, or adults, work performance.
So as we look at this technology and screen use, I think we've probably all been at a restaurant or someplace where you see a bunch of people and it looks like they're playing Battleship on their phones, right? Because they're not like talking to each other. How can this affect communication skills?
Negatively. Unfortunately, what we're seeing is with a lot of young people, the lack or loss of the skill or never having learned the skill to communicate face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball, and we need that because our brains respond to one another. I would contend that God designed us for that purpose, to connect. Also, the over-reliance on technology can lead to the inability to read and interpret body language, facial expressions, understand vocal tone, as well as it can result in impaired capacity to develop as well as convey empathy and compassion to others. So I think it's important. We're all enmeshed in the 21st century, highly technological. It'll become more so. So it's important to look at our relationship with technology. At home, we can designate device-free zones. We can also designate device-free time blocks. And we can also develop a family technology plan. If anybody is interested, there's an organization called Common Sense Media, commonsensemedia.org. Here I am plugging technology. That has articles, tips, sample agreements, and such. Likewise, the American Academy of Pediatrics has resources too.
So are there any problems that are associated with technology and kind of the influence it has on us and our families?
I think one dark side, and before I continue, I have the unfortunate role of being the bad guy here. I confess to having an iPhone in my pocket, and I love technology. That said, I'll leave it to my colleagues to talk about some of its more positive contributions. A reality, though, for young people is cyberbullying or digital bullying. This can take place via text, social media platforms such as Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, Twitter, and a whole host of tools that kids know and adults don't. Those on the receiving end of cyberbullying can experience feelings of depression, anxiety, low self-esteem. Unfortunately, I've been aware of cases in which a victim of cyberbullying has either contemplated or unfortunately completed suicide. We should all know that suicide is actually the second leading cause of death in the United States for young people between the ages of 15 and 24. In addition, digital technology can contribute to the comparison trap of benchmarking oneself by and against peers, as well as a phenomenon known as FOMO. That's an abbreviation. It sounds humorous, but there's something to it. The fear of missing out, which in turn can lead to the compulsive checking of devices and social media accounts. I read a statistic last week that said the average adult in the United States checks his or her mobile phone a minimum of 100 times a day. I don't know what the figure is for children, but I would imagine it's on par, if not more than that. Researchers are also studying how digital technology affects the brain, and specifically the pleasure-seeking and reward system in the brain, and how, in response to technology use, the brain releases feel-good chemicals such as dopamine or natural opioids. So there's a high there, which may explain the strong pull that excessive technology use has for some people. Now, you might find this humorous, but I say this in seriousness. The American Psychiatric Association is actually proposing a mental disorder called internet gaming disorder that's being recommended for further study. There are also, at this point in time, across the United States, tech detox camps for people of all ages, children, adolescents, and adults. Finally, I've overspent my time. Excessive technology use can foster, if we let it, a sedentary lifestyle. It's important to remember to move our bodies, exercise, get out into nature, and play board games face-to-face with one another.
Okay. So as we look at this, it may seem like, well, maybe we should just cut off technology or not allow it. Realistically, that would be very difficult to do. But the question is, a parent or a grandparent, you know, we understand that many of our children really prefer to communicate by text. So is it all right to kind of further this and communicate with them by text? Or should we withdraw and just say, no, we really need to speak? And how do we draw those lines? Missy, could you address that?
Say, absolutely, it is okay to communicate through text or Snapchat or their kind of preferred method. And I think there's two reasons for this. First of all, you got to keep in mind that we are their models for appropriate use of technology. Even Brian referencing 100 times for us, we're those models for them. So first of all, I would say using Snapchat or texting as a way to initially reach out to your child. Maybe it's a small thing of the day. Good luck on the test. Remember your sunscreen. Have fun. But in addition, if there's bigger things to talk about, role model for them the use of a Snapchat. So you send them something that says, I really would like to talk later. My recommendation to you is you know your kids, you know your grandkids. I have 3 kids. One loves to talk while we're walking the dog. One will only talk when you're in the car and he's way in the back seat and I can't see him. And then the other one is more in a traditional setting. Know your kid and grandchild enough to know where they're more likely to open up. Use technology is the opening of the door of that communication. Once you open that door, send a text, 3 o'clock, I'm going to be home, let's go run some errands. And now we can have that bigger conversation. The second thing I think that is very important for us in helping our kids and grandkids is in providing a comfortable place for them to practice those social skills. Brian was kind of talking about how technology is affecting their social skills. Their preferred method of communicating with peers is going to be technology. So we're the ones that can help them practice, provide an environment where you have a conversation. My rule of thumb is if it is over 2 sentences, it's not a text, it's not a Snapchat, it's a conversation. In addition, if it is asking us to go back and forth, it's eliciting information for us to talk, it's not a text or a Snapchat, that's a conversation. When we set up that time to talk to our kids in their comfortable setting, then my recommendation to you is that you are providing a safe place for them to practice those social skills. Understanding tone, reading social cues, those nonverbals, practicing eye contact. I work in a high school. I'm amazed at the number of students who will not make eye contact with me. So you're kind of the ones that get to help them use it appropriately, but then set up that time to practice social interaction.
So, Laura, from your circle of support, what would be your perspective on that?
I completely agree with Missy that texting should lead to communication. One way that texting can be used as a positive thing, our very own Pastor Tiemann and his family, when the boys went away to college, started a group text together that each day they all had to contribute something they were thankful for. They still do this every single day, even in the summer when they see each other. They all have to text something that they're thankful for. Or an idea would be something to pray for. And I truly believe that if you do that, you're going to come back together and have conversation starters right there. Wow, you said you were thankful for this, or you want to pray for this. Let's talk about that. So,
all right. Thank you. So one of the questions also was, can an imperfect family raise effective children? And more than 80% of the survey responders said that, yes, with the help of God. So, Laura, from your perspective, what would that look like?
Well, the first word is the word imperfect that I want to talk about. Imperfect is all of us. None of us is perfect. We're not perfect ourselves, and we're not raising a perfect family. That doesn't exist. And yet, through that, we can feel, I'm walking this walk that a lot of families are walking too, is this pull of where do we put our priorities? Youth sports, just extracurriculars. They are to be extra, not your thing that you just go do. And so what are we putting our kids into? How busy are our lives becoming? And then I think, unfortunately, sometimes our time with God kind of gets pushed on the back burner. If life is going good, then we're just going to just let it keep going, and we've got this. But God is our first person, and we've got to remember that. There is no greater gift that we can give our kids than their faith. I am not a sure thing. My husband's not a sure thing for my kids, but God is. And no greater gift that you can give them. And through that, here at Emmanuel, we want to support you and walk with you and enable you with that through Sunday school for the kids, vacation Bible school. The summer camps here at Emmanuel are awesome, that each day are devotions. The Upward program, just having so much of a Christian balance in that. The youth ministry program. And then on top of that, for adults, the MOPS, Mothers of Preschool program, is a great Christian group for young moms. And then small groups. I've had the pleasure of doing a little bit of Transformed already, and it is wonderful. It really will transform you and help you to be that best Christian you can be. And therefore, then you're bringing that back home to your family, and you're modeling that, and you're encouraging that with your kids. So
Kimberly, from a friends and family support circle perspective, what would be your thoughts?
I love that Laura talked about being imperfect. I love that because I think with the help of God means just that, with the help of God. And as his hands and feet, we are that to each other. I remember the crazy days of raising four kids and carpools and job and the support that my children got here in their faith as they went to school. Now my grandchildren are receiving that same support. When Matthew 25:40 says, when you've done it to the least of these, that really hits home to me because I think maybe each one of us has felt at some time, maybe right just for today, I might be the least, because it's just one of those crazy days. In those times, we have an opportunity to help each other. When my brother passed away, I couldn't sing in choir. It was almost a year before I could sing again. But the choir could sing, and I could be surrounded by that. And I had a hard time praying for a while, but my small group could pray, and I could be a part of that. And just the community here was God's way of providing what I needed at that time. So I think the support that we get from friends and our small group connections is vital. And it may be in our everyday walk, just carpools. Also, sometimes that help is just found in the way that we share our joys. When we get together for Oktoberfest or trivia night and we play and we get close and we enjoy what God has given us in this life, sometimes that is a huge support. Finally, I think I love when either pastor, grabs one of the babies after baptism and walks them around, and we all agree to be part of that help in raising that child, not just for the child, but for the family in a faith-supporting way. I think it's just a beautiful way that friends, family, and our connections here can provide support for us.
Thank you. So another question was, does our past affect our future? In other words, how I was raised, does that necessarily influence, or is that always the case? Does it always influence kind of how we raise our own kids? So I've mentioned before, I grew up in a pretty much dysfunctional family, and I'm happy to say that me and my wife, who's here today, are both excellent parents, and my daughter can attest to that. So there is hope. She's not nodding, so I'm not sure what that means. But in any case, you know, we want to take a look at this. And 76% of the people that responded said, yes, it does. And then when they break it down, well, is it either good or bad? It's interesting that about half said, yes, you know, I had great parents. They really prepared me. And I think I'm influencing my children positively. And the other half said, you know, I don't know. You know, as a dysfunctional family, I'm not sure how we're doing. We certainly have some struggles. So as we look at it, Missy, how would you address that? Knowing about our past, does that mean it's absolutely going to continue, or is there some hope?
I'd say a few things. One, I get the luxury of working in a high school. In my entire life, I've worked with adolescents. And I think inevitably when they're in a time of trial and we're talking through something, family dynamics come up. And I think there are a lot of positives, but there's also some weaknesses in all of our families. I love that we talked a little bit about imperfect. There is no perfect family. When working through that past, I think there's importance for a couple of reasons. One, our kids and our grandkids need to know our past just solely for hereditary. You know the last time you were in the doctor's office and they start to ask those questions, maternal side and paternal side, diabetes, heart disease, is there anything we should know about? But that also includes mental health and substance abuse. Our kids and grandkids need to know that hereditary piece. And I want to turn that into an empowering thing because I think, one, it can help them make better decisions for themselves. And two, just knowing that symptomology often can help them be aware of things. Second, I think knowing the past is very important for the environmental piece. Environment, how we are raised, the relationships, the dynamics in our family. A lot of times they say our kids are aware before we ever tell them. So having open communication about that, again, that idea of imperfect, we have strengths and we have weaknesses in our family. And I think not always do we have to share every detail, especially if there's been trauma. But I think in generalities, our kids and our grandkids do need to know the positives and negatives of our past. Anybody seen the movie Inside Out? Some people liked it, some didn't. Of course, high school counselor, I loved the movie. The whole lesson there is about in our lowest, we feel joy, you know, joy comes out of that. So you have to have those lows in order to have those highs. And I look at my own life and where I had struggles was oftentimes where I grew the most in strength, internally with my relationships with others and in my faith. So keeping that in mind, being open with our kids and grandkids about past, they can use that to better the next generation. They can use that to break cycles, just like Pastor Bob did.
So, Brian, as we look at family patterns and variations of mental illness, could be anxiety or depression or other things, what's your perception? How does that affect our families and what should be aware of?
First, mental illness is common. In the United States, one out of every five individuals actually has a diagnosable mental illness. That figure comes from the National Institute of Mental Health. Oftentimes, the illness could be, as Pastor Bob mentioned, anxiety or depression, which are often referred to as the common colds of mental illness. I think Missy did a fabulous job of articulating the complexity of the causes of mental illness. Certainly, biology and genetics plays a role. So too does family environment, how we're raised. Also, life events, specifically traumatic ones, can contribute to mental illness. As Missy also mentioned, I think it's important to be aware of both physical and mental illness in the family line. However, just because some of us may inherit a vulnerability or susceptibility to a mental illness does not necessarily mean that we'll develop it. You may have heard this phrase, biology is not destiny. Also, simply because some of us have learned unhealthy coping and communication skills in our family of origin, that doesn't mean that we are doomed to repeat history. Change is possible. Help and intervention for mental illness, as well as unhealthy family patterns or dynamics, are available. Counseling and medication are but two examples. Last, I think it's important to highlight the role that the human brain plays in mental illness. A psychiatrist, a medical doctor who treats mental illness with medication, will tell you that either an excess of or lack of specific chemicals known as neurotransmitters in the brain contribute to mental illness and its symptoms?
So the last question that we're going to address has to do with our families as we look at it. You know, do we have to be perfect to raise and effectively raise our children? And how does that look? And what we discovered from the responders is, no, we don't. But there's kind of, so what does a Christian family look like? Some of the responses included shares the faith in Jesus. Within the family, being honest and resolving conflicts, including words on a regular basis like loving, forgiving, serving, and grace. So as we look at these different circles of support, you know, what keeps us from engaging in any of these circles? You know, what holds us back from reaching out to get some support as we all have certain needs, especially at different times or stages of our life? So, Laura, what would you say? What would be...
Some people might be afraid to approach the church because they might be afraid that people are just going to spew scripture back out at them or just be judgmental back to them. And that we know, at least I hope we know, that that is not the case. We are full of grace and we are charged with being Christ's hands and feet and being like him and being that person that they want to come talk to and being kind and compassionate and humble. And so that is what our job is. But I think people might be a little afraid at first, thinking that you might be judgmental and ready to, quick to tell them that they're not Christian enough, let's say.
And other things might be, you know, I'm afraid to share information because I don't know what will happen with. Will the people hold my trust or not? So maybe, Missy, you could talk about confidentiality.
I like that we're up here as four different circles. I think the, simply put, confidentiality is the state of keeping something private between the two of you. And although I think family and friends can be a wonderful circle of support, because their hearts are in the right place, sometimes when someone brings me a problem as a family member or a friend, I'm likely to then open up to another family member, or how should we help her, or what should we do? And it's not always kept between the two people. Professionally, if you were to seek support from a community-based therapist or in the schools, a social worker or a counselor, we are bound ethically and legally to keep that private between the two of us. So sometimes that's just a safer environment for someone to start those conversations. I think in addition to the confidentiality piece, sometimes going to a professional, it's easier for us to be more objective. We have no other relationship with you other than what we're talking about. We don't even have any other information about you other than what you're willing to share with us. So a lot of times, not knowing the other relationships and other pieces of this, it allows us to be objective with you. I kind of look at it like your circle of friends. I always say, I have a circle of friends. There's one I absolutely go to when I need a laugh. There's another one I go to if I'm having work stress and I want to talk through things. If there's something going on with my family, that's another friend, especially raising children. Same thing. We're all here in different avenues. You just want to continue to expand your circles of support so that depending on what the issue is and where you're at, you know you always have somebody to go to.
So I don't know if you're like me. I'm more familiar with the first three levels, but there's a lot of community support. We are so blessed to live in this nation where we have so many trained people in different areas. Brian, could you talk about some of the resources that are available here in this area?
Yes. Many people don't find help simply because they're unaware of the help that exists. Many people don't know that there are national as well as local crisis hotlines that are free and confidential. McHenry County has a crisis line that operates 24/7. Also in McHenry County, there are free support groups. There's an organization called the National Alliance on Mental Illness, which has a McHenry County chapter. And again, that organization offers free support groups for those who have a mental illness as well as their family members. Speaking of technology, there is an app in McHenry County called McHelp, and that connects via text and messaging to the aforementioned crisis service, in addition to providing a database or directory of local agencies. A question that came up in the survey was, how can the church address suicide prevention and intervention? Also, the McHenry County Mental Health Board offers free training on suicide prevention and intervention. It's called QPR, which stands for Question, Persuade, and Refer. Again, it's free. It's an hour and a half workshop. One reason that people don't seek help is because of fear, shame, or stigma. People are afraid of being labeled or judged. In our society, we are more comfortable talking about brain cancer than we are in talking about schizophrenia, a devastating mental illness that affects the structure as well as the chemistry of the brain. Again, mental illness is common. You remember the figure, 1 out of 5 people in the United States is affected by a mental illness. Also, some 44,000 individuals in the United States die by suicide each year. This level of suffering and in some cases death is preventable. And it's actually a sign of strength and courage to reach out for help. One form of help, as Missy mentioned, is a confidential, trusted relationship with a counselor in which somebody learns new coping skills and techniques. Medication may be helpful for some people. Often that could be prescribed by a general physician, a nurse practitioner, or a psychiatrist.
All right. So that kind of concludes our panel discussion for today. They will be out in the lobby if you have any questions or if you'd like more information. Again, it's up on our website as well. So there's lots of different things that can help us in our struggles. Why don't we give them kind of a round of appreciation for their time?